Welcome to Reader's Digest, brought to you by Owl Radio, a community service of the Low Vision Resource Center in San Antonio. I'm John Fisher, and during the next half hour, I'll be reading articles from Reader's Digest. First, an article of national interest. One survivor now wonders whether abusers like hers deserve the harsh comeuppance they often get. Here's Geraldine DeReuter from The Washington Post with Sympathy for My Bully in Reader's Digest. As a child, I was an easy mark for playground torments. Smart, insufferably rule-abiding, decidedly unpretty. The tormentor I remember most distinctly was not my first bully, nor my last, but his attacks would turn others into footnotes. He was in my class for years. In class photos, his face is round and almost cherubic, but I remember it contorted in anger as he spat insults at me, telling me to shut up, flailing his hands against his chest, and moaning, an approximation of what he said I sounded like. We were seated next to each other year after year, and when I finally complained about this arrangement, one of my teachers said that maybe I'd be quote-unquote a good influence on him. It didn't work. His mom was also my softball coach, driving me to and from practice when my single mother could not. Sitting in the back of his mother's van after my team lost a softball game, he snapped, "It smells in here. Close your legs." Reflexively, I did as he instructed. When his mother climbed into the driver's seat, oblivious to what had happened, he was still doubled over with laughter. I was 10. When I would return home after one of my bully's taunts, tearful and broken down, I'd comfort myself with the idea that one day I would be happy and successful, and my bully would not. I internalized the bromide used to soothe all bullied children of my generation. The universe would mete out some sort of karmic justice. This idea is everywhere. Bully Biff Tannen waxes George McFly's car at the end of Back to the Future, having been beaten into submission, literally, years earlier. In A Christmas Story, Ralphie finally snaps after years of torment and attacks Farkas, who is left tearful and bleeding. Regina George, the Machiavellian queen bee in the movie Mean Girls, eventually relinquishes her bullying crown, but only after she's publicly shamed twice and flattened by a bus. Even today, the internet is rife with stories of bullies getting their comeuppance, from viral videos of little kids fighting back to Reddit threads describing justice doled out against an antagonizer. It's an age-old story, the idea of bullies getting theirs, says Megan Leahy, a licensed school counselor and parenting coach. It's a very human part of us that likes revenge. That seems only fair, right? After all, the bullies are the bad guys. According to a 2014 study that gathered data from more than 234,000 teenagers and children, victims of bullying are more than twice as likely to contemplate killing themselves as their non-bullied peers. Other studies have shown that people who are bullied are more likely to experience low self-esteem and anxiety, more inclined to abuse alcohol and drugs, and more likely to suffer from a host of physical ailments, such as headaches and sleep disturbances. During the period when I was being bullied, my mother was dealing with her own abuse at the hands of a man with whom she'd been romantically involved for several years. He fluctuated between charming and volatile. He would yell, throw furniture and other objects, punch holes in the walls of our home, and tear doors off their hinges. At the time, I'd never seen my mother's boyfriend hit her, but my bully, who lived nearby, had seen him pull my mother from her vehicle and throw her to the ground. The next day at school, my bully told everyone within earshot the story. He laughed through his impersonation of her lying on the ground, whimpering. Until that moment, I'd believed my mother when she told me that her bruised face was a result of, quote-unquote, walking into a door. As the years passed, those promises of karmic justice given to me in childhood came true. I went to college on a full ride. I graduated with honors and became a professional writer. my mother finally extricated herself from her abusive relationship. Determined not to follow in her footsteps, I sought out soft-spoken men who never yelled. I met and married someone wonderful. Everything turned out better than I could have dared hope. I occasionally searched for my bully online, determined to see my story its promised end, to relish all the ways my life was better than his. In 2010, after years of finding nothing, I learned from a friend that my bully had been murdered in his home, not far from where he grew up. Consumed by the story, I pored over every news article I could find. He had been dealing pot and was killed in a robbery gone wrong. One of the murderers had been his childhood friend. I read that he had anticipated an attack. His friends said he was so terrified in the weeks leading up to his murder that he'd slept with a hammer under his pillow. I was haunted by what I imagined his final moments were like, by how scared he must have been. I cried for the boy who had made me so miserable. Now I had to wonder, what kind of fate would I have considered sufficient retribution? Would I have been satisfied if he had become merely unsuccessful or unhappy? What sentence are we comfortable bestowing upon a fifth grader for his crimes? What is the statute of limitations for revenge? I wanted my bully's life to turn out rotten, but when it actually happened, it didn't feel like justice had been served. It felt like I'd simply watched a building collapse in slow motion. The cracks in the foundation had started long ago. In the past few years, our culture has started to see bullying as a serious problem, one whose victims need help, support, and protection. But if right-thinking people want to care about bullying as a social problem, we need to see some nuance. Look at every bully and his or her victim, and you'll often find two kids who need help, not just one. As they grow up, bullies tend to have trouble keeping jobs, often have problems with alcohol and drugs, and are more likely to have criminal records. A large number of bullies are also victims of bullying themselves. The idea that bullies themselves might be more than one-dimensional villains is hard to swallow, especially for those of us who've dealt with them. I never could have imagined feeling empathy for the boy who made my life hell, or for any bully. My bully ridiculed me for having a mother who was a victim of domestic violence. He was dead at 25. I think of his anger, his struggles in school, his unhinged rage, all at the tender age of 11. I look at the narrative we are so often told as children, that our lives will be wonderful and our bullies' lives will not, and I see the error in thinking that a troubled child somehow deserves a terrible fate. Ignore him and he'll go away, adults told me. In the end, they were right. Next from Reader's Digest, some inspiration. One woman's knack for finding good fortune. Here's Teva Harrison from The Walrus with Luck and the Four-Leaf Clover in Reader's Digest. When I was in the third grade, we had a scavenger hunt at school. We gathered up chalk, pencils, stones, and poorly hidden tchotchkes, rapidly filling our checklists. It was a very close race. I was out of breath when I reached the clover patch in search of the last, most hard-to-find item, a four-leaf clover. I was pretty sure that I was going to win. I had a trump card. The thing is, I have always been able to find four-leaf clovers. I just see them. I spent my childhood collecting and pressing four-leaf clovers into books at my mother's house. I started with big cloth and leather-bound books. Joyce's Ulysses, the complete works of Shakespeare, and my great-grandmother's copy of Les Miserables. When I ran out of romantically bound volumes, I began to slip my treasures into anything I could find. Well-thumbed fiction paperbacks, cookbooks. The same is true in my house today. Shake a book, and a papery treasure might just fall into your hand. A few years ago in Nova Scotia, my husband and I pulled off the road for a picnic. The ground was thick with clover. Some shoots had 4, 5, even 6 leaves. I lined them up on the picnic table to admire as my husband, never yet having found 1 4-leaf clover, looked on with awe. To me, it was simple. The differences in their shapes popped out, breaking the pretty pattern of the conventional clovers with their 3 perfect leaves. 2 summers back, while waiting for an airport shuttle in Munich, I found a tiny 4-leaf clover in a traffic circle and tucked it into my passport. On the way home, my husband and I were upgraded to business class. Friends attributed our good luck to the clover. I think it's more likely we were upgraded because a flight cancellation left us stranded in 2 cities on as many continents on subsequent nights, and a kind customer service rep took pity on us. People disagree about whether the luck lies in the finding or in the possession of a clover. Some believe that the luck is lost if the 4-leaf clover is even shown to somebody else, while others think the luck doubles if it is given away. I believe that positivity is compounded by sharing. I feel lucky to find the clovers so often, but I don't think they influence my life any more than it does to share anything a little special. That momentary closeness between you and a friend or a stranger, as you all lean in to wonder at a rare find. What is luck anyway? Does it mean you can't take credit for the things that happen to you? Should I have kept all the clovers I found instead of giving them away? I believe that there is casual magic in everyday acts. It's lucky simply to know what it is to seek out and love a genetically deformed clover, to know how to treasure difference. Every time I see a patch of clover, I feel a compulsion to search that cannot be satisfied until I hold a 4-leaf clover in my hands. It's a sort of mania. I had always thought that, being a simple genetic anomaly, 4-leaf clovers would be fairly common. I have since learned that 1 in 10,000 clovers has 4 leaves. It could be the result of a recessive gene, a somatic mutation, the influence of the environment, or any combination of the 3. But isn't this where science meets magic? Though I find clovers all the time, I'm not exceptional in this skill. The Guinness World Records holder, Edward Martin Sr. from Cooper Landing, Alaska, had found 111,060 four-leaf clovers when he took the record in the year 2007. It's the finding I love, not the collecting. I'm happiest to give my quote-unquote lucky clovers away. I pass them on to mothers in parks who show them to their wide-eyed kids. I delivered one to the man at my corner store, where it hangs above the register. Friends slip them between the business cards in their wallets for safekeeping. People ask how I do it. Well, I love clover. The sweet smell, the common variant with its cute trio of leaves. I look at it more than most people do. I expect that's the first reason I find so many. I have a habit of dragging my fingers or toes across a patch, momentarily separating the individuals, which brings irregularities into focus. That's part of finding them. Not a hardening of focus, but a softening. The other reason is artful. Do you remember those posters from the 1980s made up of thick dots? If you looked too hard, all you'd see was the pattern. But if you let your eyes slip out of focus, scenes would appear. Dinosaurs, landscapes, butterflies. A trick of the eye. It's the same with 4-leaf clovers. If you try too hard, you will only ever see the patch. Instead, slip into a lazy, soft focus summer state of mind. Drift your hand across a thick patch, letting the clovers reveal themselves. Appreciate the ones that have only 3 leaves. Common things are beautiful too, and a 4-leaf clover may show itself to you, just like that. That day in 3rd grade, I dived into the clover patch, skimming the surface with my hands, softening my eyes to look for irregularities. It took only moments for a 4-leaf clover to fall into my fingers. Just like that. Whatever little toy I won that day, my real prize was the gateway that the simple act of looking for clovers opened for me into a lifetime of joy derived from looking closely. the magic of nature coming up as it pleases. Next from Reader's Digest, a pair of everyday heroes. First, from Jen McCaffrey, this musician calms the dying and soothes their families. Here's Love's last refrain in Reader's Digest. When Freddie Fuller arrived to perform in the hospital room in Temple, Texas, Pam Golightly worried it was already too late. Her stepfather, Dennis Strobel, was dying. At 88 years old, Strobel had just been moved to the palliative care unit. After spending 5 days by his side, Golightly could tell that something had changed in the Korean War veteran. He had become agitated, and a nurse had told her Strobel's time was near. "You're probably wasting your time," Golightly told Fuller. But Fuller, wearing a cowboy hat and toting a Taylor acoustic guitar, shared with her what medical professionals had told him time and time again over the years. "Hearing may be the last sense to go." "Let me go in and play," Fuller said. "It's as much for you as it is for him." Fuller, 68 years old and a full-time musician, is known professionally as the Singing Cowboy. With 2 albums, the country and folk musician has performed all over the United States, as well as overseas for American troops. He also delights school kids with a one-man show called History of the Texas Cowboy, 1850 to 1900. Growing up in Salado, Texas, Fuller heard gospel music all the time from his mother. She even sang as he hung clothes on the line, and she encouraged her young son's musical talent. When she was dying of cancer, in the year 1987, he put their love of song to its greatest use. He would crawl into her hospital bed with his guitar and sing her favorites, "Amazing Grace," "Just a Closer Walk with Thee," and "I'll Fly Away." His mother seemed to relax, a peaceful look crossing her face. That moment allowed her and I to connect like we used to when I was singing as a child, Fuller recalls. It emphasized to him the power of music. Consciously or subconsciously, people allow it to go to deep, sacred parts of their hearts and souls, Fuller believes. So when he heard about a nonprofit organization called Swan Songs, he gave them a call. Since the year 2005, Swan Songs has arranged more than 800 free musical last wishes. Bedside performers from bagpipers to mariachi bands, at hospitals, hospices, and private homes in and around Austin, Texas. Fuller signed up on the spot. Since then, he has performed dozens of musical vigils. Sometimes they're almost festive, with terminally ill people surrounded by family, including one patient who sang along and danced gingerly with her walker. Other times, they're quieter, as Fuller's experience with his mom was. And sometimes they feel a bit like a miracle. That was the case with Golightly's stepfather. He enjoyed country music, and Swan Songs sent Fuller. When Fuller arrived at the hospital that day last February, Strobel seemed ready to say goodbye. Golightly and her sister, Paula Guetta, watched their stepdad's every breath, each holding one of his hands. Fuller played some Willie Nelson, Merle Haggard, and Jackson Brown songs. After 45 minutes, Golightly asked for just one more song. Fuller chose "Love Me," a country ballad by Colin Ray. "I played the last song, sang the last note, and hit the last guitar chord, and he took his last breath," Fuller says. She, her sister, and I looked at one another saying, "Oh my gosh, we just experienced one of the most magical moments in our lives." "It was a gift for us all," Golightly said of Fuller's singing. "At a really sad time, it was beautiful." Next from Reader's Digest, here's Andy Simmons with his everyday hero story, A White Knight in the Aisle Seat. Soon after Savannah Phillips got buckled into her window seat on a United Airlines flight from Oklahoma to Illinois this past May, she glanced over at her seatmate. He was in his 60s, wore bright yellow sunglasses, and was busy texting. The font was unusually large and the screen was bright, making it easy for Phillips to read what he was tapping out. "Hey, babe, I'm sitting next to a smelly fatty." It was like confirmation of the negative things I think about myself on a daily basis, the 33-year-old mother wrote in a Facebook post after the flight. Soon tears streamed down her cheeks as she hugged the cabin wall, trying to make herself as small as possible. Sitting a row behind them and across the aisle was Chase Irwin, a 35-year-old bar manager from Nashville, Tennessee. He could see the man's texts, too, and he could see Phillips. "I noticed her looking at his phone," Irwin told WSMV.com. "I was sick to my stomach. I could not have this guy sit next to her this whole flight and her thinking he's making fun of her," he told Nashville's News Channel 5. In an instant, Irwin had unbuckled his seatbelt and was hovering over the texter. "Hey, I need to talk to you," Irwin told him. "We are switching seats. Now." When the texter asked why, Irwin said, "You're texting about her, and I'm not putting up with that." The texter acceded quickly. Irwin took his place next to Phillips and was soon cheering up his new seatmate. "He encouraged me not to let that guy get to me and that everything was going to be fine," Phillips wrote. And he was right. She and Irwin spent the rest of the flight chatting like old friends. With her faith in humanity restored, Phillips wrote on Facebook, the flight attendant told him that he was her hero. He wasn't her hero. He was mine. Next from Reader's Digest, wish you were more creative? Just pretend. Thinking you aren't gifted may be what's blocking your inner artist. Here's Susan Nielsen from The Cut in Reader's Digest. I want to ask you a favor. I have a pair of pants. Tell me, how many different ways can I put a pair of pants to use? Now imagine you're an architect. Same question. Now imagine you're Cher, Bill Gates, a scuba diver, a medieval knight. You still have the pants. What alternative uses come to mind? What you have just practiced, the conscious act of quote-unquote wearing another self, is an exercise that, according to psychiatrist Srini Pillai, MD, is essential to being creative. One great irony about our collective obsession with creativity is that we tend to frame it in uncreative ways. That is to say, most of us marry creativity to our concept of self. Either we are quote-unquote creative, or we aren't, without much of a middle ground. "I'm just not a creative person," a frustrated student might say in art class, while another might blame her talent at painting for her difficulties in math, deflecting with a comment such as, "I'm very right-brained." Dr. Pillai, a tech entrepreneur and an assistant professor at Harvard University, has spent a good chunk of his career subverting these ideas. He believes that the key to unlocking your creative potential is to defy the cliched advice that urges you to quote-unquote believe in yourself. In fact, you should do the opposite. Believe you are someone else. Dr. Pillai points to a 2016 study demonstrating the impact of stereotypes on one's behavior. The authors, educational psychologists Dennis Dumas and Kevin Dunbar, divided their college student subjects into three groups, instructing the members of one to think of themselves as quote-unquote eccentric poets, and the members of another to imagine they were quote-unquote rigid librarians. And the third group was the control. The researchers then presented all the participants with 10 ordinary objects, including a fork, a carrot, and a pair of pants, and asked them to come up with as many different uses as possible for each one. Those who were asked to imagine themselves as eccentric poets came up with the widest range of ideas, whereas those in the rigid librarian group had the fewest. Meanwhile, the researchers found only small differences in students' creativity levels across academic majors. In fact, the physics majors inhabiting the personas of eccentric poets came up with more ideas than the art majors did. These results, write Dumas and Dunbar, suggest that creativity is not an individual trait, but a, quote, malleable product of context and perspective, unquote. Everyone can be creative as long as he or she feels like a creative person. Dr. Pillay's work takes this a step further. He argues that simply identifying yourself as creative is less powerful than taking the bold creative step of imagining you are somebody else. This exercise, which he calls psychological Halloweenism, refers to the conscious action of inhabiting another persona. An actor may employ this technique to get into character, but anyone can use it. According to Dr. Pillay, it works because it is an act of quote-unquote conscious unfocus, a way of stimulating the default mode network, a collection of brain regions that spring into action when you're not focused on a specific task or thought. The default mode network may be quiet, but it's hardly idle. It spends all day rummaging through our memories and collaging ideas together. Unfortunately, those ideas often get drowned out because most of us spend way too much time worrying, and about two things in particular: how successful, unsuccessful we are, and how little we're focusing on the task at hand. These twin worries feed on each other. An unfocused person is an unsuccessful one, we believe, and so we don't allow our minds to wander into its quietly fertile fields. Instead, we buy noise-canceling headphones, knuckle down, and berate ourselves for taking breaks. What makes Dr. Pillay's argument resonate is its healthy, forgiving realism. According to him, most people spend nearly half of their days in a state of quote-unquote unfocus. This doesn't make us slackers, it makes us human. The quietly revolutionary idea behind psychological Halloweenism is, what if we stopped judging ourselves for our mental downtime and instead starting harnessing it? Putting this new spin on daydreaming means tackling two problems at once. You're making yourself more creative, and you're giving yourself permission to do something you'd otherwise feel guilty about. Imagining yourself in a new situation or an entirely new identity never felt so productive. And let's conclude this edition of Reader's Digest with news from the world of medicine. A blood test that may warn of Alzheimer's sooner. The only way to catch Alzheimer's early, allowing treatment to slow the progression of symptoms, is through expensive imaging or invasive tests. Now researchers have developed a blood test that they hope will spot the amyloid beta that forms brain plaque, a hallmark of the disease. Working with archived blood that had been collected between July 2000 and December 2002 from participants in a study of adults ages 50 to 75, they compared samples from 65 people who were later diagnosed with Alzheimer's to more than 800 controls. The new test correctly identified those with the disease in almost 70% of the cases, and it would have done so as many as 8 years before they received their diagnosis using current tests. And sensitive toothpaste isn't enough. Many toothpastes claim to treat sensitive teeth, but researchers recently found they don't help much. A tooth grows sensitive when its protective enamel erodes, exposing dentin, a layer with tubules that lead to the nerves. The researchers tested 9 quote-unquote anti-erosive and or quote-unquote desensitizing products and found that they all caused enamel wear, just like regular toothpastes. Some desensitizing toothpastes might help to block pain, but you likely also need to see your dentist for other treatment options. Thank you for listening to today's Reader's Digest. If you have questions or comments about the program, please call us at 210-829-4223. This program is replayed after 9 o'clock in the evening. This is John Fisher saying goodbye from Owl Radio and the Low Vision Resource Center in San Antonio.